Everybody, Baruch Hashem, I think we're over with political campaigns, at least in Yerushalayim for a while, till next time, and Bezos Hashem. You know, it's interesting, someone asked me a very good kasha. There's a pasuk in Mishlei that Chazal use a lot. Lev melachim v'sarim biyad Hashem. And that means, the way the Mefarshim explain, that those who rule over a country or over a society are not really exercising free will, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu mandates what their decisions are going to be. For good or for bad, whatever the situation is, it is not really an issue of Bechira, but Leiv Malachim B'Sarim B'Yad Hashem. So the philosophical question is a very interesting question. So L'mai Nafka Mina, what difference does it make who you vote for, or if you vote at all, if indeed all decisions of politicians are based on HaKadosh Baruch Hu deciding what is right in that given situation? But again, it's a very complicated idea, and that is, what Hashem decides is in effect affected by our ishtadlus. So in other words, the decisions we make determine what the hashgacha pratis is going to be. So in a sense, our input would still be important. Be it as it may, I want to just make preliminarily bring up a very interesting halachic point that emerges, a big machlokes Rashi and the Rambam. We know that at the end of the Parsha, Avram, after Sarah dies, Avram takes a wife. Her name is Keturah. Now, literally, this seems to be another woman, but as you know, Rashi interprets from the Medrash that Keturah, in fact, is Hagar, and she is called Keturah because she became a righteous woman after Sarah's death. Noem Maaseha Kiktores. Her deeds are as sweet and pleasant as incense. And from Keturah, Avram had a number of children. Some of them became the progenitors of familiar nations that were our enemies. For example, Midian is one of the B'nai Keturah. We know the Midianites later we had wars with and the like. Now the Gemara says in Sanhedrin that B'nai Keturah are chayavim chrismila, that the children of Keturah are treated as Avraham's children, and although they are not Jewish, they are not chayav in mitzvos, but the B'nai Keturah are chayav in chrismila on the eighth day. This is a Torah requirement. The halacha requires the descendants of Keturah to have chrismila. But there's a tremendous argument between Rashi and the Rambam. According to Rashi, let me say that first, the obligation of the Mila of B'nai Keturah are only those eight children, meaning it is not a mitzvah that applies today. Those eight children had to have bris Mila. Their descendants did not have to have bris Mila. So according to Rashi, there is absolutely no difference between Yishmael and the other B'nai Keturah, who after all, they're full siblings. Yishmael had to have a bris. Halachically, his descendants do not have to have a bris. Halachically. The children of Keturah, who are Yishmael's brothers, had to have a bris. Halachically, their descendants don't have to have a bris. So according to Rashi, the children of Keturah are identical in halachic status to the children of Yishmael. They all had to undergo a bris mila, but it did not carry over to their next generation. The Rambam argues. The Rambam actually says that B'nai Keturah, all of the descendants of Keturah, are mechuyev to have a bris mila even today. But Yishmael was not chayev today. Again, unlike the Islamic practice, Yishmael is not chayev. It was only Yishmael that had a bris. At the age of 13, it did not have to go to the next generation. Now, you might ask a question, according to the Rambam, what is the logic of this? Why? Because after all, Yishmael is the child of Hagar and Avraham, and the B'nai Keturah are the children of Hagar and Avraham, albeit she is renamed. Why would B'nai Keturah have more of an obligation than B'nai Yishmael? Our assumption would be because after Hagar became a Balas Tshuva, her righteousness was much greater, and therefore there is a certain amount of holiness to her children. Now, after the Rambam says B'nai Keturah are chayav in bris mila, and Bnei Yishmael are not chayiv in Bris Milah, the Rambam then says the following halacha. Since over the years, the Bnei Keturah and the Bnei Yishmael intermingled and intermarried, it is impossible to identify which of the Arab peoples are a direct descendant of Yishmael and which is a descendant of the other Bnei Keturah. All of the Arab nations are chayev under Torah law in Bris Milah. Not because they're descended from Yishmael. According to the Rambam, if one could show he was directly descended from Yishmael, he would not be chayev in Bris Milah. It's only if they would be descended from Bnei Keturah, but since we're not sure because of the Yishmael Bnei Keturah intermingling, they are all chayev in Bris Milah misafek. Misafek means out of doubt. So, number one, you see a few things. You see that this is absolutely the opposite of the claim of Islam, right? Islam claims that they circumcise because they are descended from Yishmael. In point of fact, halakhically, being descended from Yishmael does not obligate you in Bris Milah. It is being descended from the other Bnei Keturah that obligates you. Number two, the chiyuv of Bris Milah for the Bnei Keturah, and because of the Safek, all Bnei Yishmael, is 8 days old. Now, the Islamic practice is a little murky. Many people think, but it's really mistakenly, that Islamic circumcision is at the age of 13, modeled after Yishmael. It actually is not, but it's not 8 days either. It's somewhere like, you know, between 5 and 10, they tend to do a circumcision. It's hard to know what their makor is, where they get that, as it were. But it's interesting that, indeed, according to the Rambam, the Arab peoples are mechuyev under Torah law to circumcise, but not because of their descent from Yishmael, but because of their descent from the other Bnei Keturah, which it is uncertain. Was there a question? Okay. All right, so this is a machlok I just wanted to share with you, and again, the Islamic practice is somewhat borrowed from this, but it does not really correspond with halachic requirements. Okay. Now, the other thing I want to talk about is a general theme, which the Meshech Chachma talks about in a lot of places, but it comes to real fruition in this part of the Torah. And that is the concept of repetitive narratives. Throughout the Torah, we have a phenomenon where the Torah tells you something and then it repeats the story, sometimes more than once. One outstanding example, which we're not going to talk about today, but just to bring it out, is the construction of the Mishkan. Hashem gives Moshe a very detailed set of commandments, A to Z. Then Moshe tells Bnei Yisrael, A to Z. And then Bnei Yisrael do it, A to Z. And then Hashem says, oh, Baruch Hashem, they did it, A to Z. Every time it is repeated. Now, the Torah could have said, Moshe told Bnei Yisrael everything Hashem said. Leave it at that. Bnei Yisrael did everything Moshe said. Leave it at that. And yet the Torah repeats the details over and over. Another outstanding example, when the Mishkan was dedicated, every day of the dedication for 12 days, a Nasi, the head of a tribe, brought a korban, or a bunch of korbanos, and the korbanos of every single Nasi was identical. And the Torah repeats it over and over again. That's one of the reasons why Parshas Naso happens to be Parsha. But for a Baal Koreh, it's a bit of a relief, because the Tamei HaNegina are exactly the same. Although, my event when I was in 7th grade on Hanukkah, we read this also, because Hanukkah is the dedication of the Mikdash. So I figured I was supposed to read the last day of Hanukkah. And so I figured, it's going to be easy, just the 12th Nasi. But I didn't recognize then that it carries over into Baloscha, the next Parsha. So I still remember that when they told me the next Aliyah goes to the next Parsha, little nervousness. But okay. But generally speaking, the repetition of 12 times, right? So what do you do with repetitions? So some Mefarshim don't really pay a lot of attention to it. They just say, oh, the Torah repeats, Dibra Torah, Kolashon B'nai Adam, the Torah speaks the way human beings speak. I repeat a story, you repeat a story. Sometimes it shows how much Hashem cares about something. It's a sign of chavivus, a sign of love, etc. So some beforeshim do not make a big deal about repetitions. In fact, Rashi, for one, does not. In fact, just if you open up a Chumash Shmos, on Truma and Tetzava, which is Hashem's commandments about the Mishkan, Rashi gives you a lot of commentary. Vayakel Pekude, when it's actually carried out, Rashi doesn't say anything. He just says, ah, same thing as I told you over there. Similarly, there's a similar machlokas in some ways to the notions of synonyms. Is there such a concept in the Lashon HaTorah, or Tanakh generally, of synonyms? Right? If HaKadosh Baruch Hu, let's say Yirmiyahu says, like we say at a wedding, there'll be a kol sason v'kol simcha, rejoicing, kol chasa, right? Etc. Gila, rina, ditza, v'chedva. We call these synonyms. Words that joy, jubilation, rejoicing, ecstasy. What is the meaning of all of these things? So the Radak and the Eben Ezra and the Abarbanel are actually not so troubled by this. They have a phrase that they use quite often. Kefel ha'inyin b'milim shonot. The idea is repeated with different words. It's poetic. It's a way of elegant expression, etc. This is one approach, which might be disappointing for us. There is, of course, the other approach, which is exemplified by the Malbim to an extreme degree. Now, the Malbim was a 19th century great commentator, where the Malbim basically says, and this, I think, is almost the mainstream idea that we communicate in our yeshivas, but it is a machlokas. The Malbim says there is absolutely no such thing as synonyms in the Lashon of the Torah. That things that sound the same have different nuances, they have different meanings. There's a reason why one pasuk will say simcha and one pasuk will say sason. They are not the same, they are not simply piling up adjectives or nouns. And the Malbim is relentless. The Malbim is actually fairly ruthless here, and the Malbim will say every time you have these two terms, he'll try to give you a difference between them. And before the Malbim, this was the approach of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna, in fact, there's a whole story. they record a story about, you know, the 19th century, or the 18th century, 19th century was the period called Haskalah. Haskalah literally means enlightenment, but really, from a religious perspective, it was not the greatest period. And this is when many, many Jews were leaving the fold of Torah because they wanted to explore university education and the like. And as a result, the Maskilim, to the extent they were involved in Jewish learning, were not so involved in Gemara and Halacha, but they were involved more in biblical studies. In fact, I mentioned a few weeks ago, that is why on the religious camp, there were so many commentaries on Tanakh in the 19th century, designed to counteract the arguments of the Maskilim and the Reform movement that Torah Shebaal Peh was a fake interpretation. So there was a Maskil, he actually writes this in his memoirs, who had a great, great desire to meet the Vilna Gaon. This was an early Maskil. But, you know, he had to make believe he was a religious person, so to speak, more religious person, so he dressed up appropriately. He comes to the Vilna Gaon, and he shows to the Vilna Gaon his different observations on Tanakh, and on Psukim, and on Diktuk. You know, so the Vilna Gaon listened for a while. Then the Vilna Gaon asked him, what is the difference between this term of Simcha and that term of Simcha? And the person says, well, in Biblical Hebrew, they're really the same. They're just different ways of saying the same thing. So the Vilna Gaon just turned away, refused to talk to him. Right? So the meeting was over, basically. The Vilna Gaon didn't yell, didn't scream. The meeting was over. But apparently the word spread that the Vilna Gaon turned his face away from the person. So as he walks out, he is taken by the community leaders. He is literally tarred and feathered and taken out of town with a sign over his neck, so shall be done to not be chorus and a kofer. So if you try to take the position kefel ha'inyan b'milim shonot in Vilna, you might actually be tarred and feathered. What would have happened to the Radak, the Eben Ezra, and the Abarbanel? you know, who knows? But indeed, this is actually the approach that they espouse. Right, so we have different views about how you look at repetition, how you look at synonyms. Are these things that you focus on or not? Now, a similar type of problem we have in the story of the shidduch of Yitzchak and Rivka. We know, of course, Avraham Avinu has a dilemma. Avraham Avinu does not want Yitzchak to marry a Canaanite woman because they're corrupt, they're idolatrous, whatever the reason, we'll talk about that. On the other hand, Yitzchak is not allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael because of the holiness of being an Akedah. As a result, Yitzchak is very, very passive in his choice of marriage partner. Avraham Avinu designates his faithful servant Eliezer to carry out a shlichus. Now, as you undoubtedly noticed, there's a tremendous amount of repetition in this narrative. Step one is a conversation Avraham has with Eliezer. Step two, Eliezer devises a test. Step three, the woman, Rivka, passes the test. Step four, Eliezer tells the whole story over to Besuel and Lavan. And each time, the whole thing is repeated. Now, if you think about this, if you wanted to economize the amount of words that you devote, you could have said, Avram told Eliezer the following thing. Eliezer devised the test. Those two parts you need. Then we would say, Rivka passed the test, and Lavan and Besuel were told that she passed, you know, this is the right woman, etc. Why is there a need to repeat all the details every single time? The Gemara says, offers a very short observation. The Gemara says, we see from here that Hashem loves even the conversation of the slaves of the Avos more than all of the Torah that he gave to their children. Because when Hashem gives us the Torah, Hashem will often teach a single halacha with a word or a letter. The Torah will not waste a pasuk if it could teach you something in a letter. But here, the Torah goes on and on and on because there is chavibus, the great love and affection for everything connected to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So the Gemara itself is not omed on reasons for the repetition, other than to note it is a sign of chavivus, a sign of love and affection. But in truth, Mefarshim point out a very, very important idea. The Mesher Chachma talks about this. And he says, when you look at repetitions, you must pay very careful attention to the fact that something is never repeated exactly the same way. There are differences. There are discrepancies. Sometimes there are things in the original account that are eliminated, omitted in the second account. And sometimes there are details in the second account that didn't appear in the first account. So the significance of repetitions might lie precisely not so much in what is being replicated, but in what is being changed. The Torah repeats a story so you will focus on the differences in the repetitive narratives, and those differences can teach you a tremendous amount of lessons. The Torah has many, many ways of teaching you lessons, and one of the ways is by repeating a narrative with somewhat of a different nuance and a different focus, and by comparing the two, you can extract some very, very subtle lessons. One great example besides this one, again, maybe I shouldn't bring it up because this really deserves a share of its own, is Rav Soloveitchik's very, very beautiful essay, The Lonely Man of Faith, in which he takes the two accounts of how Adam and Chava were created, and he shows they represent two aspects of how a human being is supposed to focus in the world. He calls it Adam 1 and Adam 2, but again, that really deserves a share of its own. So now, if you look at the various iterations of the Eliezer-Rivka story, The Abarbanel notes, for example, no fewer than 50 differences. Now, some of them are indeed very, very small, and we're not going to focus on 50. But I want to focus on 4 or 5, and then show you how the Meshech Chachma, the Nitziv, go through these differences and what it teaches us. Difference number one is what Eliezer's mission was when Avraham told him, and what Eliezer said his mission was to Lavan and Bethuel. Avraham told Eliezer, well, another thing, which is not a difference, but one point I want to keep in mind, you know, Nechama Leibowitz used to point out, I've mentioned this a lot of times, that we're so used to certain midrashim that we are absolutely certain they are in the text of the Chumash, when in fact they're not there at all. Everybody knows Eliezer was the servant that was sent to find a wife for Yitzhak. Everybody knows that. And most people would say, well, the Chumash says it. Actually, it doesn't. It does not tell you who this person is. It just talks about Eved Avraham. Now, we know from other places Eliezer was Eved Avraham, but he was not the only Eved Avraham. And yet, we know instinctively, and Chazal tell us indeed, that this was Eliezer. One thing to note before we even get to discrepancies is, why is Eliezer's name not mentioned here at all? Why is he so anonymous? Why isn't he given credit for the great accomplishment? Keep that as one question. But focusing on discrepancies, Avram told Eliezer, do not take a wife from the Canaanite people with whom we live, but go El Artzi V'El Moladeti. Go to my land. Now, Moladeti, this is a tricky word. The simple standard translation is, go to my land and the place of my birth. Which actually means, if you translate it that way, Abraham actually never said, you should go to my family. Avram simply said, go to my place of origin. Now, the reason why this depends is because Moledes itself has two translations. Moledes can mean place of birth, or Moledes can mean family of birth. And the reason why there's a problem here is because Eliezer went to Haran. Now, Haran does not, we talked about this, does not seem to be the place where Avraham was born. Avraham seemed to have been born in Ur Kasdim, and Haran was a way station. And that would suggest, therefore, if Eliezer goes to Haran, Moledes does not mean place of birth. It may mean family. And yet, many, many Mefarshim do say Avraham was born in Haran. They work it out. And Moledes is place of birth. So this is the Mahalach of the Meshech Chachma. Let's go with this. And that is, Avraham did not say family. Avraham specified location. Now, when Eliezer recounts this conversation later, he says, my father, my master told me to go El Beis Avi Umishpachti. Go to my father's home and my family. Eliezer changed it from Artsi and Moladeti to Beis Avi Umishpachti. It is Eliezer that changed the emphasis from geographical location to family. That's just difference number one. Okay, yeah.
Wasn't Eliezer upset?
Yeah, we'll come to that. Yeah, we'll come to that. Okay. Yeah, we'll come to that. Discrepancy number two. Eliezer devises a mission. Not a mission. Eliezer devises a test to see who would be the suitable woman. And Eliezer chooses, for reasons that will become clear, a test of character, of midos, of chesed, of kindness. And he says, I'm going to ask a young woman, and I will say, please give me water to drink. So I ask only for myself. I don't ask for my animals. And if the woman says, I'll give you and your animals, she goes beyond what I ask, that is the woman that you, Hashem, have chosen. Now, Note what he said, what he said was supposed to happen. I will ask her, give me water. And she says, I'll give you and your animals. Is that what Rivka exactly did? That actually wasn't the exact thing. He asks Rivka for water. She draws water for him. And after he drinks, does she then say, I will draw water for the animals? So she didn't say exactly what he wanted, but she did better. Because her chesed was actually greater than he stipulated. Why is this? Because if she would have said, I'll give you and your camels, number one, that implies kind of a lack of human dignity. You and the animals are the same. And number two, it may give Eliezer the idea that she's only going to draw water once, so he'll have to not drink everything he needs. By waiting until he finished and then offering. So the point is this. She did not comply with the conditions of the test 100% accurately. But as a test of character, she did better. She did 110%. She showed a chesed and a compassion. And of course, if you learn like Chazal and Rashi, that she was only 3 years old, it's quite an unusual story. you might figure, hey, get your own water. You know, what are you bothering me? I'm a 3-year-old kid. I always say, though, when you come to Yerushalayim, you know, we always wonder, how could a 3-year-old do these things? But, you know, we see 3, 4-year-olds, I don't know what age they are, but, you know, they're walking around in makolets and getting things. So, you know, it is possible. Yeah. That's correct, yeah. Well, no, the Chumash mentions that the young girls went out to draw, it says plural, they went out to draw water. Rivka was the one. Now, we don't know, did Eliezer approach other women? It's not clear. Did he ask other women and they said, no, don't bother me? We don't know. Did he hit gold at the first sight, etc.? But it does mention that other women were there. That much it does say. Now, so Rivka did not do exactly what Eliezer said, but she did better. Interestingly enough, though, when Eliezer recounts the conversation to Lavan, because Bethuel had died in the middle, right? Lavan tried to poison Yaakov, and it got switched, and Bethuel dies. So Lavan, who is Rivka's brother, winds up doing the negotiations. Eliezer does not mention the extra thing he did. Eliezer just said, I said that if I ask for water, and she will offer me and my camels, and indeed, Rivka said, I will give you and your camels. In other words, Eliezer made the correspondence more exact than in fact it was, even though that diminished some of the chesed. That is discrepancy number two. Discrepancy number three. The Chumash records that after she gave him the water and the camels and drew up extra water for the camels, Eliezer immediately gave her the jewelry and the wealth that he brought. And only afterwards did he ask her, Basmiat, who's your father? He didn't even know until he gave her the jewelry. But when he tells it over to Lavan, he says, I then asked her, who is your father? And when she said Bethuel, then I gave her the jewelry. And Rashi explains he didn't want to say he gave her the jewelry first, because then Lavan would say, you're an idiot, you didn't even know this was the right person. So he changed it to make sense. But if he changed it to make sense, why didn't he do it the right way? Why did he do it in a logical way? Right? The sequence of jewelry is different. Let me backtrack as well. And that is, we know Rashi brings a well-known medrash, that's what you mentioned, that Eliezer himself had a daughter, and Eliezer was very much hoping that Avram would consider his daughter as a possible shidduch, and Avram said no, even to Eliezer. Now, how do Chazal know that drasha? Because when Eliezer asks the question, ulai lo soaveh, Haisha la leches. Perhaps the woman won't want to go. What do I do then? So the word ulai, which is perhaps, is normally spelt with a vav, but in the Torah it's spelt without a vav, and without a vav it could be read Eli, what about me? But here's the interesting thing. In Eliezer's conversation with Avram's conversation with Eliezer, ulai is spelt with a vav. The double entendre of Eli and ulai does not appear in that conversation. It is only when Eliezer talks to Lavan is the Eli, when he recounts the conversation. So it's interesting, the double entendre of Eliezer's daughter being rejected does not appear in the initial conversation. It only appears in the retelling of the conversation. And a final discrepancy, I'll review it briefly, the final discrepancy is, when Eliezer asks Avraham, what if she doesn't want to go? Shall I take your son there? In the initial conversation, Avraham says, Chas v'shalom, do not take my son there. In the conversation with Lavan, when Eliezer brings up, I asked my master, what if the woman doesn't want to go? That negation is not stated. Avraham is said to have said, oh, Baruch Hashem, everything will work out. The idea is, don't take him there, is omitted. So b'kitzer, I don't know how many I've mentioned, but b'kitzer, we see a number of things. Number one, which is not a contradiction, but why is Eliezer's name not mentioned in the narrative at all? Why is he so anonymous? The only phrase that is used is Eved Avraham. Number two, change of mission. Avraham focused on place, Eliezer changes it to family. Number three, Rivka does not do exactly what Eliezer stipulated. She does better. But in the accounting, Eliezer makes it the same. Number four, in the Maisa, Eliezer gives the jewelry first and then asks, Basmiat? But in the recounting, he says, Basmiat, and then asks for the jewelry, then gives the jewelry. And number five, which is really the earliest one, and that is, Eliezer omits in the recounting the extreme negative response Avram had to taking Yitzchak to Canaan. He just Haran. He simply leaves it out. Right? So how do you understand all of these different discrepancies? And indeed, the fact that the Torah tells the story over with these differences, meaning you're supposed to notice the differences and understand that they're teaching you something. So let's start off with a fundamental yesod from the Drasha Saran. The Ran was one of the Rabbeinu Nissan, one of the great Rishonim. The Sefer Drasho Saran is a very, very important Sefer of a general Hashkafa of Yadus and the like. And he doesn't go into these differences, but he asks a very basic question, and that is, Eliezer has a daughter. Eliezer is righteous. Eliezer is a tzaddik. Eliezer is Avram's devoted Talmud. Avram's family or Avram's location, what are they? They're Ovdei Avodah Zarah. They are pagans. How could Avram prefer either his family or his city, whatever it would be, to a righteous person like Eliezer? Is Avram like such a Baal Gaiva Chas V'Shalom that his family is better than anyone else? So the Drasha Saran says a very important idea, and if any of you have children in the Parsha of Shiduchim or grandchildren, something to be aware of, think about. And he says the following. Avram knew that Eliezer was a tzaddik. But Avram also knew that the Canaanite people, had within their personality a streak of cruelty and achzorius. Now granted, we would have to assume Eliezer was kovesh that, conquered that. But still, the Ran says, if a person beteva does not have a lev tov, a good heart, does not have rachamim, that's extremely difficult to change, and even if the person managed to change it, it doesn't necessarily come over into the next generation, and it might come out again. The one thing Avraham knew about his family and about his place is the people beteva, in their nature, were kind and compassionate and caring people. Says the Ran, in looking for a shidduch, looking for the quality of a lev tov, justifies even taking an Oved Avodah Zarah. If you have a choice between super frum but cruel, and not so firm, but kind-hearted. The Drasha Saran says, it's not me, so don't quote it in my name, the Drasha Saran says, one should choose the Leif Tov, because Avodah Zarah is a cognitive mistake. A person has a wrong belief system. Beliefs can be changed by education, by chinuch, by proper learning and hashkafa. But midos of the leif are very, very difficult to change. And therefore one has to look very hard for the leif tov, the rachamim. And that explains why Eliezer devised this test, because who told Eliezer to devise that particular test? The answer is, that's exactly why Avram is telling him, not the Canaanim. Avram is telling him, go to my community because of the Midah of Chesed. So Eliezer knows he has to look for someone that is mitztayenet, that excels in the Midah of Chesed. This was not superstition. Eliezer is not saying, you know, the first woman that wears a red dress is the right wife. This is not superstition. No, this is not omen. This is based on the logic of why he was sent to that particular place, the Midah of Chesed. Actually, it's reminiscent. People ask the question a lot. You know, many of the Talmidim, really, almost all of them in Or Shmach, come from non-religious homes. So, you know, people get married and they want to be Eretz Yisrael, Charedim, they want to really be, you know, B'nai Torah, knows Torah. And they often wonder about allowing their children to be too connected to their unreligious, non-religious grandchildren, grandparents, or uncles, or aunts, or whatever it is. And the truth of the matter is, the Chazon Ish actually said that there is much less danger in exposing your children to non-religious people than it is to expose your children to religious people with bad midos. Because bad midos are contagious in a way that maybe a lack of religiosity in Bein Adam L'Makom is not. So for example, if a child is raised to know about kashrus, to know about Shabbos, and to understand that some Jews, unfortunately, may not be keeping those mitzvahs yet, they can be strong. They can know. They can know to turn down a candy, to turn down this and that. But midos can really undermine a person. If people are, they lie, they cheat, they're cruel, they insult people, they make fun of people. Those are things that children do pick up, unfortunately. And therefore the Chazon Ish says, we should be less worried about children sometimes being with people who are less meticulous in mitzvot, as long as the child has the right chinuch, and more worried about children being with those who are very missing in those tovos. That's, again, something to think about. Okay, so this is the important yesod of the Drasha Saran, that the single most important quality then one looks for, at least in the wife, again, it's not so clear what the Ran would say, if that's the most important quality of the husband, that's an interesting question, is a leif tov, rachamim, chesed, caring, wanting to help people. So with this Drasha Saran, we now have a mafteach, a key to unlock all of the other differences that were mentioned. First, mission. Avraham focused on geography and not family. It could very well be Avraham didn't care if it was his family or not his family. He knew that the community of Haran were Gomlei Chasadim. So he didn't care. He just said, go to this place where the people have Rachmanis. As a result, Eliezer devised a test of Rachmanis, of Chesed. Rivka did more than the test. That was fine. Eliezer gives her the jewelry without asking Bas Miat, because it didn't make a difference. He asked afterwards as a just to get more information. But in terms of the shalichus was based on community, based on midos. She passed the test. She did more than was necessary. And therefore, Eliezer's behavior was totally logical. But here is the thing. Eliezer has a very difficult job in front of him. Rivka is extremely young. According to Chazal, she's 3 years old. By the way, there's another opinion in Tosos and Yevamos that she was 14 years old. But still, relatively young. She's going to be taken to a foreign country very, very far away. So, obviously, there's going to be resistance. So Eliezer needs to flatter the Mechutanim to convince them that this is a good deal on their part. And he's allowed to lie. Now, I'm not suggesting you can lie in Shidduchim generally. As a matter of fact, that's a very, very severe Aveira. But to extricate Rivka from a makam of Avodah Zarah is a spiritual pikuach nefesh. For that, you're allowed to lie. So Eliezer is changing the emphasis by emphasizing that the great and famous Avraham, who is known throughout that part of the world, specifically wants a shidduch with you. He can't just come to Avraham and say, he can't just come to Lavan or Besuel and say, I was sent to find a girl from this city. So Lavan says to go find somebody else. The emphasis has to be Avraham, the great and famous Avraham, the Nesi Elokim, asked for you. Eliezer changes it from geography to family to bolster the ego of Lavan so that Lavan would feel so flattered that he was chosen that he would agree. Flattery. Appealing to gaiva. So, the change in the definition of the mission was to appeal to Lavan's gaiva. Now, the second deviation is how to understand the test. Eliezer's understanding was the test is a test of character and midos. The fact that Rivka didn't do it exactly, that's not a chisaron in the test. If anything, she did better than expected, so that was fine. But when Eliezer is presenting it to Lavan, Eliezer has to use a different aspect. Eliezer is presenting the test not as one of midos, but as a superstitious omen that the gods, small g, have approved of this. Now, omens are very different than character signs. Omens are only omens if you believe in them. Many are superstitious. Only if it's exact. Close enough or better isn't good enough. So since Eliezer is trying to convince a recalcitrant Lavan that this is a good idea, he can't just show, Rivka's a nice girl, she did more than I asked her to do. That's not good enough. Lavan could say, there are other nice girls in Haran, what are you bothering me? He has to say, no. I made a prediction that the woman that I say, give me water, and she will say these words, I will give you and your camels. He had to show that Rivka did exactly that. Because Eliezer is redefining the test, not as a test of character, but as a superstitious omen from the gods that Lavan will be responsive to. And that's why the correspondence has to be exact. Now, as generations of children have discovered, whenever you have a lie, you have to be sure to change all parts of your story. Because if your story is inconsistent, you'll be caught in the lie. Now here's the thing. When Eliezer was only focusing on geography and chesed, he could give her the jewelry without knowing whose daughter she was. But once he changed the mission into family, he had to change his story of the sequence as well. He had to say, I first asked Basmiat, and then I gave her the jewelry, because otherwise Lavan would say, you didn't know. So Eliezer was very smart in when he made one change, he had to make another change. Because he changed it from geography to family, he had to change the recounting of the sequence. Moreover, I had mentioned that he didn't reiterate Abraham's negative response, do not take my son there. He didn't say that. The reason is very simple. If you're trying to flatter your potential mechutanim, you don't want to say, by the way, my master says he would never let his son spend a minute in your house. That's not the best way to be in their good graces. So he finesses that by saying, Avram promised me everything would work out. Didn't say that negation. Now with this you see an amazing thing. You see the greatness and the godliness of Eliezer. First of all, Eliezer has what we would call a conflict of interest. He very much wants his daughter to marry. And if indeed the case would be Rivka would refuse to go or Lavan would refuse to let her go, his daughter might be the next in line. So not only does he faithfully carry out. I just want to be sure this is on. 1 second. Yeah. Not only does he faithfully carry out Avram Shlichas, but he changes and deviates from the terms of that Shlichas to maximize its success. Now, he could have said exactly what Avram told him. He could have said, I was sent to find a girl in Haran. And he could have said, and Rivka didn't do exactly, but she was pretty close. And he would have been in full compliance with his mission. And perhaps what would have happened would be that they'd say no. And he did everything right. So you see the faithfulness of Eliezer. That not only did he not sabotage the mission, which he might have done, but he even improved, he changed the mission to maximize success. And this, the Marshal writes, is why his name is not mentioned. He was so loyal and faithful that he did not exist as a separate person. He was nothing more than the servant of Avraham. And this also mentions the final thing. I mentioned that the double entendre of the Eli and the Ula only appears in the conversation with Lavan. Here is the point. This is a bit of an interpretation. When he is actually talking to Avraham, he does not communicate to Avram he has a daughter. He understands implicitly Avram is not accepting it. But when he's talking to Avram, he's only faithful to Avram. When he's talking to Lavan, what he's doing is he is revealing his personal humiliation to maximize the shidduch by saying, listen, I had a daughter and I am so close to Avram. And he rejected me because he wants you. Look what Eliezer is doing. He is shaming himself in front of Lavan to be able to be Zchatanah. So you see a remarkable thing. So these differences are really, really remarkable in terms of the godless, the greatness of Eliezer. And in fact, Eliezer doesn't always get the credit that he deserves here. Again, one has to imagine how painful it must have been that for whatever reason, Avram did not choose Eliezer. In fact, there's a very sure Rashi, I don't have a good shot in this. Rashi states, that even had Rivka not come, and as a result, we would have to take a Canaanite wife, the runners-up would be Oner Eshkol. In other words, it's Machpel, Eliezer wouldn't have even have been the second choice. That's very difficult. That is very difficult to understand because once you're taking Canaanite women, why not the daughter of Eliezer? That is Akasha, and that's a very difficult Rashi. But certainly we can see that in spite of Eliezer's pain, he did his faithful shalichas. By the way, Chazal say that the first... Yeah.
Why couldn't it have been if Lavan would have said no, it could have been another girl from...
That could be. Apparently there wasn't, but that could have been too. In other words, obviously, you don't get to stage two unless there's no woman in Haran that fits this parameter. You know, Chazal say that the very first person who used the phrase that we use today ubiquitously, Baruch Hashem, was Yisro. Because after Yitzias Mitzrayim, Yisro says, Baruch Hashem asher hitzil eschem. Blessed is Hashem that saved you. And indeed, the Medrash says there's even a taina. Why didn't Bnei Yisrael and why didn't Moshe Rabbeinu say Baruch Hashem, whatever that would have meant? But the truth of the matter is, it's a kasha on the Medrash. Because the first person who said Baruch Hashem is actually Eliezer. When Eliezer... Huh? The Medrash... that's what I'm saying, it's a kasha on the Medrash. The Medrash says the first one was Yisrael. But the Chumash says Eliezer said it. So you have a problem. Eliezer is not given credit. Eliezer is the first person recorded in the Chumash, he's before Yisrael, who said Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem. All right, the Netziv has an... The Netziv has... I'm sorry, what's that?
No, if you're saying, I want to ask a question.
Sure. No, so the Netziv... Huh?
As Yeshiva.
Yeah. So it's true, but it doesn't have the words Baruch Hashem. The Medrash says there's something unique about the Shevach of Baruch Hashem that even the Yaz Yashir doesn't encompass. All right, the Netziv has a whole Arichas that Eliezer was the first one... Huh? Right after in Chayisara, right after Rivka is the right woman, he says Baruch Hashem that enabled me to fulfill the shalichus of Avram. It's mamish in the Chumash, Baruch Hashem. So the Netziv has an arichos. He says that Yetzias Mitzrayim is a miracle beyond nature. It is a supernatural miracle. Eliezer, the whole thing was not a supernatural miracle, but it was an unfolding of Hashem's Hashkacha Pratis in normal life. You know, the right woman, the right time, etc. So the Baruch Hashem of Eliezer was recognizing HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the ordinary life. Yisrael was recognizing Hashem in the miraculous part of life, etc. The Neis Nigla and the Neis Nister, so they're two different things. But still, Eliezer does have that unique distinction of Baruch Hashem. Yeah?
My question is...
Yeah. Yeah.
Why wasn't his name mentioned at all?
No, I understand, but in a way that could be the greatest shevach. In other words, the Torah, again, through Torah Shabbal Peh, we know it's Eliezer, so we know it's him. And by mentioning Eved Avram without his name, the Torah is telling me, here is a man who acted with no personal agenda at all.
But you said Avram had other Eved Avram.
Yeah.
There were other Eved Avram.
Yeah. No, I understand. So that's why we have...
assumption.
I understand. No, but we have Torah Shabbal Peh that tells us this. Okay. So we know this. And once we know this, B'Mesora, the very anonymity of him is the greatest compliment. The Torah is telling me there was no Eliezer mixed into this at all.
He wasn't his personal guide.
That's what I'm saying.
Just
he was totally a shaliach of Avram. That's right. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, actually, the truth of the matter is, it's somewhat similar to the chesed of Bnei Yishmael, Bizman Hazeh, which is a different family, Bnei Yishmael. And that is, the Arabs are actually, to this day, very, very hospitable, but they will kill you and rob you on the way out. Meaning, it is a perversion, because without Torah, Midos do not exist in a coordinated, consistent framework of values. That's really the thing. There can be the possibilities of generosity and kindness, which on some level is genuine, combined with lust and violence and everything else. Because without Torah, you can live on those conflicting planes. Well, this is what the Ran suggests. That's all I'm saying. This is what the Drushus Haran suggests. You know, and he says this was the teva. This is how Avram himself had that teva of chesed coming from Haran. Yeah.
Maybe Eliezer remained anonymous to be instructive that when an agent does something and shaliach does something for principle, okay?
Yeah.
You have to follow exactly what he says and remove yourself from your personal agenda.
Right. Well, that's very true, but that's very difficult at the same time.
Very difficult.
It is very difficult, and it's considered to be a very high compliment that he was able to do that. It's a distinction. Yeah. I'm not aware of it. I'm gonna check because it would seem implausible that he did not get a tremendous reward for this. But I'm not aware of Olam Hazeh, any particular reward to his descendants. I just want to mention one other thought, one very quick thought. The Ran emphasizes that the choice of Rivka was because of Chesed. Some learn it a little differently. Some learn it that it's not so much Chesed per se, but it's the need to counterbalance, and that is the notion that Abraham represented loving kindness. He needed to be counterbalanced by Sarah Imenu, that had the quality of inner strength and discipline. Yitzchak, who represented the Midah of Gevura, needed a counterbalance with the Midah of Chesed, which means to say, the old idea of opposites attract, that each one must incorporate. Now again, it's not simply, you know, my Chesed needs someone else's Gevura, but rather, through the interaction, the Baal Chesed becomes stronger and more disciplined, and the Baal Gevura becomes kinder and more open, and each one develops the qualities from the other one, and each one becomes a Davar Sholem. This is reminiscent of a famous story involving George Bernard Shaw and a famous entertainer, where she once remarked to him, "If we would get married, with my looks and your brains, we'd have wonderful children." And he said, "What if it would be your brains and my looks? We'd be in trouble." So it can happen sometimes that in interactions we pick up the bad from the other. But in an ideal shidduch, each one grows by incorporating. But the Shema Shmuel says, Yitzchak could not be born until Avram the Baal Chesed did an act of apparent cruelty, circumcising Yishmael and his children and his slaves, and Sarah, the Balas Gevura, had to be involved directly in Chesed, Hachnasas Orchim. So when Sarah took in the Chesed and Avram took in the Gevura, you then had a Shlemus. Each one incorporated from the other, and then you had a Shlemus out of which Yitzchak could be born. So again, something to think about. But again, this is a general lesson which goes beyond this parsha. And that is, when you have repetitions, always pay attention to discrepancies and differences, because that'll be the key to understanding what the Torah is teaching you. Yeah.